The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Welcome aboard. This is Andrew Horowitz, the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And thanks so much for coming on board today. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in and subscribing. We have a great show today. We're going to be talking about the issue of transparency. You know, who do you believe? Who do you trust? Who do you want to have as your, I guess, you know, your trusted source of information? And there's so many things out there and so many places out there right now to get information. And we really have to question what, in fact, is the good stuff from the bull stuff, right? And it's harder and harder these days because the internet has allowed for us to get information instantaneously at our fingertips. But, you know, there are some places we need to be very, very careful, because if you start using the wrong information, maybe there's a bias involved. Well, I think what's going to happen is your results are going to be swayed and skewed, and you're not going to really be able to invest properly. So what I did was put together a world-class panel of people that really know this subject backwards and forwards. Do me a favor, sit back, get ready, because Disciplined Investor starts right now.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Call for your free brochure today. Toll free, dial 888-964-7526. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
All right, as promised, we have a great panel today. We just have a group of people today that is going to really knock your socks off when we talk about this topic of who can you trust in the electronic age. It's an issue that I think is extremely pertinent today. So, gentlemen, we have John Dvorak, who is a noted market commentator with MarketWatch.com, also of the very famous and infamous Dvorak.org/blog, and the vice president of Podshow. So, John, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Great, thanks. And we also have John Havens, who's an author and vice president of business development with Blog Talk Radio. And he's going to, I'm sure, he's actually one of the inspirations for this show. So thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
And Parker Conrad, who is the founder of Wickinvest.com, is with us today as well to shed some light on some of the things that are going on in his world, a brand new startup site that has a lot to offer.
Thanks
for being here. All right, let's start right off here with this whole idea of, and here's my premise. You know, we've gone quickly from this whole idea of we would have way back when only newspapers, maybe the daily TV, radio, to listen to the markets and to find out what's going on. And we've kind of jumped all the way into this whole area of information is at your fingertips at all times. We have this information overflow. And as I say, it's kind of like trying to take a sip out of an open fire hydrant, right? I mean, but who do we trust these days? Anybody?
Well, I think we can trust you, Andrew.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, okay. Thanks. Who else can we trust besides me? Or who can't we trust? I mean, what are we looking at these days that are concerns for anybody?
Well, let me jump in since everyone seems to be hesitating. You know, one of the things we have to deal with is, or at least the people out there who go online and try to get information, they're going to have to change their style, because it's just not as easy as it used to be, where you'd have trusted sources that were obvious. Trusted sources, which is kind of the key to this whole thing, are actually harder to identify, and often yeah. Some of the better ones are extremely obscure. And you nowadays, it's like kind of going to the doctor. You have to get a second opinion on everything, because right. If you're told you have cancer, that is. I mean, if you're just going to go there to get a vitamin shot or something, yeah, it's no big deal. But the fact of the matter is, and a lot of people just can't get used to the fact that they maybe have to do a little more work on their side. The one thing about the internet you have to remember is kind of a self-service thing. And it's kind of like an on-demand thing. It's a little different than it used to be when people throw stuff in your face. Now you have to go out and actually do something on your side so these other guys can make a lot of money.
Well, the other thing is, you know, what I really have a problem with, and this is not a slam on Google by any means, but I don't know about you, but I've been going on Google trying to find things and search out things. And, you know, it used to be maybe 6 months ago even that it was kind of easy to refine your searches. Now there's just a load of crap thrown at you from every angle. I mean, is anybody finding that as well? You know, you can't really get refined information for what you're looking for?
This is John Havens, and I have to agree with that and with what John just said. You know, online, just because we have this huge amount of information, that doesn't necessarily mean all that information is positive, that it's vetted by any editors, that it's necessarily something that's trustworthy just because it's been posted. That's obvious. But for me—
Now, John, let me interrupt you so everybody knows what you're talking about. Tell me about vetting. explain that to the folks that don't understand that.
Well, it's a tough call. There's a book I'm reading right now. It's very interesting. I don't agree with a lot of what he's saying, but I think his name is Andrew Keen. It's A Cult of the Amateur. He's sort of opinionated, or his opinion is that with the influx of so much stuff online, that we don't have the cultural gatekeepers, is what he calls them, of, you know, journalists like from the New York Times or Wall Street Journal, or people who have been trained in the craft of writing, and then who have an editorial staff who vets or edits their work, in the sense that there's a large group of people working to make sure that material is researched appropriately, has a lot of sources, and that people can chime in and try to make it as, you know, quote, true as possible. What's tough is that, obviously, as wonderful as the New York Times is, and certainly I give huge value to the craft for someone who works at the Times. You know, you have to be obviously a pretty good writer and journalist to be with the Times. You know, I do with a lot of stuff that Keane's saying. What I don't necessarily agree with is that, you know, obviously someone from the Times still has an opinion. The Times itself is owned by, you know, a larger conglomerate, and they have a voice, and it's a paradigm. But that said, online, you typically don't have a lot of those vetting processes. So then what can make a blog popular is the sheer personality of the person who writes it. And very quickly, my background is I was an actor for 15 years. And, you know, being a professional actor, being in all the unions, having been on Broadway and film and TV, one thing that was irritating to me is I could audition for something, having 15 years in the business. Someone who had just decided to act 4 days before could go in an audition, and if they looked the right way and
yeah, they get the part.
So I kind of equate that, where I think it's a similar online situation now, where it doesn't mean that someone who is blogging doesn't deserve to be read. It just means that the standards that for them to post their thoughts are very different from traditional publications.
Now, let me skip over to Parker. Parker, yeah, let me skip over to you, because I think you're going to have a different opinion on this.
Yeah. I think I wouldn't call it quite a different opinion, because I agree that, you know, there are some amazing publications out there, like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, that, you know, their editorial structures are nothing to be laughed at. But I also think that there are sort of two important things to keep in mind. One is that I think that people are generally fairly good at sort of evaluating content, you know, evaluating its tone, evaluating sort of the whether paragraphs and sentences are well written and complete, and, you know, there is sort of a rational argument behind it. So I think, you know, even when you're reading a blog, people seem to be very good about people seem to be very good at figuring out who knows what they're talking about and who doesn't. But I also think that there are a lot of sort of there are a lot of platforms out there like Wikipedia, and I hope Wikinvest as well, that create a system where it's where actually information, because it's seen by so many people, can be quite accurate. I was astounded to learn friends of mine from college who are now in medical school were telling me that, like, the way that they get through medical school and the way that all their friends get through medical school is via Wikipedia. You know, that's like sort of a major source for them to study for their exams and do stuff like that. And these are guys, you know, they're not at slouch schools. They're at, you know, UCSF and Harvard Medical School and places like that. So I think...
Yeah, but doesn't that show you that the reality is that at this point, because of the infancy of the web and where we are and the information out there, that people really don't know where to look? I mean, the reality is, how many people have been astounded to find out that Wikipedia information could be changed on the fly anonymously?
Yeah.
Now, maybe it's better than it was, et cetera. Maybe it's not. And
I think
maybe, you know, Jimmy Swales.
That's one of those things that, like, sounds very scary when you first think about it. And you're like, oh, my God, like, anyone can change it. But if you go on and you look at sort of how long changes last on the site, I think you'll find that, yeah, you know, there are routinely people on Wikipedia who come online and they vandalize stuff and they insert sort of nonsense or bad jokes or scatological humor.
Yeah, but the problem is, here's the problem I have.
Yeah.
Here's the problem I have. Gentlemen, listen to this. You know, on Wikipedia, it's one thing changing a discussion of how the ventricle and the arteries work in the heart to, you know, discuss it, or even whether it's done maliciously or not. It's another thing entirely to come on and discuss something financially where you have an axe to grind, or frankly, you know, a financial gain or not to make with what you write. And that's the problem I have with the fact that there is none of this this discussion going on, and the fact that there is this kind of lack of oversight. We're going to get back to this in 1 second when we come back, because I want to discuss this. Hold on right now. We're going to just do a quick break, and when we come back, I want to pick up on, you know, the fact that when people are writing information on these blogs, you know, about a stock, about an investment, do we believe them? Hang on. We'll be right back.
Stick around for more of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Looking for answers to today's complex financial markets? Then get your copy of The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, your all-in-one guide to investing. Pre-order now at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. The Disciplined Investor. Together we will reach success.
In 3, 2, 1. And now back to the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
All right, we're back here, and we're again talking with three fine gentlemen, John Dvorak, John Havens, and Parker Conrad, about who do you trust out there. And when we left off, we were mentioning this whole thing about if somebody writes something on a blog post, how do you trust them? John Dvorak, how do you trust them if they're writing about a stock?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different ways of doing it. One of the things you have, you know, if there's a big blog, which is what I'm always looking for, is like a blog that's got a lot of activity. You can get, if you, and they leave the comments open, you're going to get a lot of feedback that you can read. And the feedback, the comments, actually are part of the blog post nowadays.
Right.
And so you don't necessarily trust the original poster. You read between the lines with all the other stuff that goes on. So you actually end up reading a lot more than you used to.
So you get a dialogue.
The dialogue is very important.
Which is interesting because that's something that was always missing, I thought, from other forms of communication like television or radio. Well, radio may be different, but television clearly and newspaper. Radio was the only one for years that you would have the opportunity to have a dialogue with somebody. Now people can comment. I mean, I can't tell you how many times that I've posted and people have said, you know, opposite discussions and all that. And, you know, whether or not they were right or wrong in the end is really, you know, up to the end process. But I think the bigger issue here is this whole idea of transparency. And John Havens and I, John, I know you're in the process of writing a book on the issue of transparency on the web, right?
Yeah, I've been working on a project with a great guy named Shel Holtz, and we're in that process, but we definitely, you know, we want to work together, and that's something we're moving forward on, yes.
So, are you doing it because you perceive there is a problem with transparency? Disclosure?
I get interested in transparency. I was lead organizer for an event called PodCamp NYC, which happened last April in New York, and it was an unconference, which is we used a wiki. So I'm a big fan of wikis, by the way, Parker. And people can sign up to speak and be they're a participant versus an attendee, meaning we wanted to create a conversation versus a monologue. We based it on a movement called PodCamp that happened last year in Boston, and I had a great, great time running it. We had about 850 people come. We got a lot of nice press, CNET and stuff. So really felt like we were able to move beyond just sort of the podcasting community and got to the media world as the whole. NPR came. It was great. What I found in that process, however, was that managing, quote, community interests with folks who didn't necessarily get or even to a certain degree care about new media, that's where I get interested in transparency because I'm very much an advocate for wikis, all new media tools. What I find, however, is that blogs, it's very easy to be snarky, sometimes nasty, sometimes to post opinions that can damage. In this case, we were running an event and there were certain posts that went up that, you know, I would always want people to post whatever they wanted to. But what I became very interested in is the line between transparency and full disclosure.
Yeah.
I think it's wonderful that companies, and I of course would always urge companies be transparent as possible with certain financial disclosure things that have to happen. If there's, quote, a mistake that happens, that they talk about that on their blog. But I think sometimes there's a pressure to give full disclosure, which I think is inappropriate. And so I think
– I'll challenge you to find that people when they, you know, are gonna eat their mistakes. How rarely is it that somebody comes out and says, you know what, I was wrong about that? Or I mean, they just don't do it. It's rare. I mean, nobody eats crow. No, it just doesn't happen out there these days because the amount of information out there, it's almost like, you know, we forget things. Listen, IMUS is going to be back on the radio soon. How fast we forget about things. You know, we're not kind of, unfortunately, we're not holding anybody's feet to the fire these days, which brings me full circle back to Parker. Parker, what are you doing? You know, you have this site. By the way, Parker, just to let you know, kudos, the site looks great. I mean, you got a lot of that Ajax stuff going on there, right? You know, with this really cool kind of inline pop-up boxes with really nice graphics. I mean, it's a great site to initially look at, first of all. And second of all, I think that it has the opportunity to be really great. But who is it at the end of the day who's looking over and watching to make sure that nobody is kind of messing with the internals?
Yeah. So I think you know, Andrew, you bring up a good point, which is this idea of oversight. I think where I would disagree with you is that you assume that in sort of most of these areas online, there is no oversight. And I think the areas where new media can be really successful, or the platforms, the new media platforms that are really successful, are ones where they do sort of solve that problem very well. So you look at something like Wikipedia and something like, you know, Wikinvest, hopefully. I think there is one of the reasons that, that wikis can be so successful is if they get a lot of traffic and have a lot of users, there is a tremendous amount of oversight. So you see on Wikipedia, I remember seeing just thousands and thousands and thousands of words of argument on a discussion page about North Korea, about very simple things like whether Kim Jong-il should be referred to as a dictator of North Korea or the leader of North Korea or the president of North Korea.
Fascinating.
And this was going on and on and on.
Right.
People, if someone tries to make a change on a wiki like that, what happens is very quickly, usually in a matter of seconds, unless it's sort of been approved by a group of other people, it will be changed back.
Yeah,
it will
now,
be changed back so quickly that no one will ever see it.
Yeah, but now let me get to John Dvorak for a second and ask you a question. So now I understand that, and I understand that what you have is the opportunity to kind of – the idea of a wiki is to take the entire consciousness of people if there's – you know, and kind of put it there, and it's going to be changed and adjusted till it's refined just right. But at the same time, we talk about how – you know, you have the comments and all that, John, right? And we know some people, and I recently heard, I mean, they just, you know, they didn't like the bad comments, so they just took their comment section off their website. I mean, we've heard of things like that, right?
You know, it happens all the time. In fact, that's a very common thing, because what happens often is that you end up with kind of comment deterioration. And by the way, this happens, I think, on anything that's online that the public's contributing to. It's like a very weird form of entropy. And it happens on Wikipedia to some extent too. There's a lot of bad information on that site. I mean, I only use it for taking an overview or trying to catch up with something that I know absolutely nothing about. And the Wikipedia will take you up to a fast, you know, it'll get you going. It'll launch the rocket.
Right.
But it provides you with definitive information by any means. And I mean, we were just doing a story today on Cranky Geeks, where this is a guy who has done an algorithm to just track IP addresses of everybody who ever posts on Wikipedia, and he found that there's a whole bunch of, you know, kind of pretenders out there that are posting all kinds of propaganda. And the one of them that they pointed out was the continuing changes that takes place on the Walmart site, where the original poster put something like, you know, Walmart pays a lousy wage, to Walmart pays twice the minimum wage. I mean, it's just a very small change, but enough to make, you know, you think differently about these things. And that's a part of a public relations scheme. And that's where this is all dangerous, is because public relations professionals have got more time and money on their hands than any of us do. And they go in there and they can start tweaking things. And they can tweak things and kind of bend the perception just a little bit. And it doesn't take that much. And they can do it on forums. They can do it on the wikis. They can do it all over the place because they got time to do it. And before you know it, we're not seeing a reality that we need to see. We're seeing some sort of the same kind of skewed reality we see every place else where the PR world is involved.
Yeah, I just have the bigger problem I have with all this is that I guess that I focus on the issue of finance, and it's become such a personal matter where we now start possibly. You know, getting into someone's pocket where, you know, somebody starts really saying, oh, you know, prime example, I've talked about it before, right? I think it was the Engadget advanced news relief or the 2 week later release of the information about the iPhone, which we saw, they said there was going to be a reduction in the sales, and all of a sudden Apple goes down 8 points. I mean, you know, that is very damaging. And the bigger question is then you have to back it up with, you know, who's responsible? Who's going to pay me back my $8? Parker, I mean, you know, where do we go for, you know, when we want to find somebody and say, hey, you know what, that guy, ABC Jones, was telling me all sorts of bad things about that stock, and he was just really shorting the stock, and the truth of the matter is I listened to him, and I shouldn't have. I mean, you know, what happens then?
Well, so, I mean, I remember that particular incident with Apple stock. I mean, it was back up 20 minutes later, right?
Right,
I think people will make mistakes. There will be errors. Engadget will make mistakes, but so does the New York Times, and so do, you know, institutions with a lot of these controls. I think a lot of the higher end blogs, by the way, like Engadget, resemble traditional newspapers much more than anyone understands. I mean, they have, you know, professional journalists with editors and a whole structure behind it. So I don't think that something like Engadget isn't sort of any more prone to error than a lot of other publications.
Yeah, but the only difference is that they're kind of live, whereas maybe some of the other publications, which, by the way, I prefer getting my news fast, hot, and quick, right? But at the same time, they have the ability to really saturate a market very quickly, particularly with RSS these days. Now, without getting into all the technology, because it's more of a financial discussion, a financial show, you know, with what's going on with the markets these days and what's going on in the world these days, we get back to the original thesis here is that, if we have promoters out there and PR and all that going on with these stocks, you know, is there a way for an individual? Can anybody think of a way for an individual to say, okay, this is a safe site or at least a reasonably safe site. I can trust this site for at least having my interest at heart rather than someone else's? John Havens?
Well, here's the thing I found about wikis, because I'm kind of in the middle of, like I said, this Cult of the Amateur book. I get the sense, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, I haven't finished it, that his author prefers the traditional sort of New York Times situation where someone is vetted and researched and yada yada. But I love wikis, and I love the conversations that come from there. And as Parker pointed out, there's a wisdom of crowds I found with wikis that I love, where it's also kind of a nice checks and balances. If someone's really unfair or if they're wrong, it's actually one of the best places to get erroneous information at least challenged, because someone is going to say, well, I just read the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times and they didn't say that. So in one sense, the paradigm of a wiki allows you to take the aggregate information from a lot of different sources. But again, the trouble is that then it's opinions of sources. As an author for, New York Times would be as well. Anyway, to get back to your question, I think back to a point John Dvorak made is that start off with either a person or an outlet you trust, a blog or a website, depending if it's a financial thing or a lawyer or that type of thing. There are certain credentials that, at least for me, I want a doctor who's an MD. Call me crazy. That's helpful. I want a lawyer who's gone to law school, and I don't mean to sound pejorative with regards to other professions. I just mean those things are certain hallmarks that make me feel they're trustworthy.
So let me paraphrase you. I think what you're saying here is credentials are important, background is important, and professionalism, right? I mean, is that versus a guy who may be well known for something, but maybe he doesn't have the credentials; he does it in his part time. Someone who is just toying around and writing, it may sound interesting, but what you're saying is, you want someone who is, credentialed and professional, and that is, that has, background in this. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, in a client list, someone could be extremely smart about the financial market and they should be lauded for that, for their wisdom. But then if I'm going to pay that person money to take my money, I would want to say, great, do you have a sample of your client list? I think that's fair, and that's a distinction.
I hear you. So,
Andrew, I would say one other thing there. Yep. I maybe sort of care less about credentials than John does. I think what's most important to me is, and I think it's something that anyone can do and anyone can tell just by reading what someone writes, is understand when they make claims, how do they support them? So if you see someone who writes in their blog like, man, this company's really hot, buy this stock, ! That's not someone I'd really rely on. But if someone, says that and then backs it up and says, here are sort of the five or six reasons why I think this company is really poised to succeed, and is able to take you through the logic around, here's the way sort of this business is evolving, here's the way the market's evolving, here's why this company is poised to succeed,
The only problem we have with that is they can sound as intelligent as the day is long, but if the fact is, if their background information is poor and their writing is good, that's the only problem I have. I mean, I've seen stupendous writers looking. I mean, I had a gentleman who responded to a post that I wrote about a company, and he wrote this long discussion. As a matter of fact, it was in mid-July, and I was saying that there's a real problem with these markets, and I started to talk about it. Then towards the end of July, I started writing, and I write an article called Sinkhole Alert. Be really careful. Now, he writes a discussion that says, look at all the shares that traded. Because of all the shares that have traded today and because of what's going on, if you look at the numbers, it's actually a net positive for the markets because the gain he gave. And I said, are you kidding me? The market was down 250 points and you're telling me there's a lot more buyers and a lot more money in the market today? I mean, I don't know where he's going with this. You know, it's a simple, you know, he's just trying to support whatever he could with, you know, grasping at straws.
Look at what you just said. I mean, you were able, you know, if he constructs an argument as opposed to just making a claim, you're able to evaluate it. You're able to say, this doesn't make sense. You know, A doesn't connect to B.
That's me.
Then you're able to say,
I've been doing
this
for 20 years.
I'm not going to listen to this guy.
I guess, but I know how to discern the real numbers. But you know, they're starting to, he threw out a couple of interesting theories and some calculations. And at the end, I had to look at it two or three times to say, this is just hogwash. I mean,
But Andrew, what difference is it? Well, how's that different than it's ever been? I mean, we have seen the newsletter scams from, like, you know, this is like going to the horse track.
Right.
I mean, there's all those guys lined out in front, and they have their picks, and you have to, like, pay your $5 to get the tip sheet, and it either works or it doesn't. And I don't see that anything's really changed. I mean, the only thing the net has done is it's made it kind of work a little faster than it used to, but it's the same basic kind of, you know, this guy seems like he knows what he's talking about. I'll trust him. I mean, I was listening to somebody analyze, for example, on the radio. I listen to sports talk too much. an unbelievable rationalization for who would win the last Kentucky Derby. And I was actually thinking of taking the bet because the rationalization was unbelievably convincing.
Right.
And this horse came in eighth.
I guess it's, you know, these horse races that we live in, you know, you have to be, I guess the word is discerning and understand what you're making sure that the cream is rising to the top. And that's what you're going after, because you're right. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of common sense. That's what we have to use here is the bottom line.
Andrew, I think the point about the Kentucky Derby horse, I think that raises sort of an uncomfortable truth here, which is no matter how credentialed you are and no matter how much you know about this market, it's incredibly unlikely that someone's able to consistently generate returns that are above the level of the market.
Well, the bigger problem is, right, because the bigger problem is that
we're
finding out that the core information that we're getting is crap. You know, the fact is that the guys who are supposed to know, they don't know. The guys that are supposed to know from the companies themselves, look at these financials imploding on themselves. You know, so how do you make good judgments if the information you're getting is just total, you know, to use your horse discussion, horse cocky? I mean, it's just pathetic.
Yeah, and this is John Havens cutting in. I do have to say that, and I don't mean to be hyperbolic, but I do have to say experience still does mean something. You know, like, don't get me wrong, I really appreciate a good writer, and a well-constructed argument is a sign that someone can have wisdom in a certain category. But there's also a lot of people who are professionals and have a lot of experience and are suck at writing. You know, I ghost wrote a book for a doctor on the nature of opiate addiction, right? So that's there's a lot of things going on now. So I would interview someone from a pharmaceutical company, and I'd be talking to a PR guy who was one of the best speakers I'd ever spoken to. Then I'd talk to a scientist at Harvard about, you know, the nature of cocaine, who sounded like he learned how to talk, I don't know, out of a box, you know, whatever. He was horrible at speaking, but he was brilliant, you know. And so I do have to say, I don't think it's wise to just assume because someone puts a good argument on the page. Don't get me wrong, give them full credit. And of course, and Parker, I'm not trying to mitigate what you're saying. Obviously, you know, they're going to back it up with an argument that's, you know, maybe has links and, you know, it's whatever. But I think it is a slippery slope to just say because someone, and I'm not saying you're saying this, Parker, but to say that just because someone is a sound writer, that their experience doesn't count for something. And with I'm not as cognizant of financial markets, but again, I go back to the doctor analogy. Someone could talk a good game, but, you know, where are they coming from? Who's their experience? And again, the paradigm, we haven't even touched that, you know, American medicine versus holistic medicine. My dad's a psychiatrist. I tell him about, you know, chiropractic, and he looks at me like I'm an idiot.
Uh-oh.
You know, but that's,
I don't do that.
Yeah. But anyway, so the point there is I do think experience matters a lot, and that's something that can be dangerous with the nature of, you know, being able to publish something right away and look like an expert.
Yep. John, you've been around for a while. John Dvorak, what is it? You know, you've also been involved in mainstream media, we'll call it that. You know, you have a position with MarketWatch. You're also, you know, involved in overseeing some of the workings of Podshow, et cetera. I mean, what is the general concept? What is the consensus of, you know, media with what's gone on these days with the podcasts and blogs and all this that's gone on? I mean, is it a good thing, a bad thing? Is it dilutive?
Yeah, no, I've worked for the newspaper business or in the newspaper industry, and I think I'm big time magazines. And I think, you know, there's just a general, to be honest about it, as far as I can tell, there's a general panic because instead of like doing their jobs nowadays, they're just essentially crunching numbers and trying to figure out how to sustain a business in an environment that's essentially slowly shutting them off.
Yeah.
from anything. And one of the things that we're witnessing, which is a kind of weird, because there was a Henry Blodgett just did a post. In fact, I'm going to do this on my next. I have a thing called Tech 5. You go to tech5.podshow.com if you want to listen to it, but it's a daily news rundown. And one of the things I ran into somebody else talking about was Henry's, you know, he did something on how newspapers are screwed, and he went into an analysis of why the newspaper business is so doomed to online. And there's some truth to it, but the one mistake he made, I believe, is the way he outlined how to fix the problem. And one of the problems he foresaw, and apparently other people think this way, is that the content creation is what's costing all the money and killing these guys. Mm. Now, to bring a personal anecdote into this, I just had a lunch with Will Hurst like 3 or 4 days ago, who's, you know, the Hearst Corporation we're talking about.
Sure.
He's the executive committee on the board. And he was, you know, telling me just point blank. He says, this is a bunch of bull. He says, the fact of the matter is that the San Francisco Examiner or any major newspaper, if you really do the numbers and you know what you're doing, the total amount of money it costs to do content creation is 10% of the expense. And once you start eliminating all these other expenses, you know, there's no reason to get rid of these writers. And everything seems to always be oriented toward, you know, getting rid of what we're talking about here today, which are people that know what they're talking about.
Right.
So we have, you know, we have a consolidation of everybody's using Associated Press and Reuters, and they're trying to thin down their ranks. And we're having less and less of these people who know what they're talking about because they've been trained to do research, and they've been, you know, they know how to tell a good story with accuracy. They're out on the street, and I think a lot of them are actually gravitating to this online world, and they're showing up all over the place. But we don't, you know, they're harder to identify since they never self-promoted like somebody like myself does.
Right. Well, is, and not to knock the Henry Blodgett, but wasn't he the gentleman who back in the 2000s was the Mr. Technology? Is that the same guy?
Yeah, I heard that.
And he was the guy that I think was kind of banned from the securities industry? Same guy?
Well, same guy, mm-hmm. curiously. But mm-hmm. the thing that's interesting to me is that he's, again, this is another example of telling a convincing story. Because if you read this and you didn't know anything, the newspapers are screwed. In fact, I think people in the newspaper industry would read this, and many of them would think that, even though if they knew, you know, if they actually looked at the numbers, they know this was not the case. But the thing is, you still see this at these papers, and not to change the subject too much, but they're, you know, what's happening in many of these papers is they're cutting back on the people who create content.
Right.
And these are people who know how to do it right. And yeah. So we're getting less of that, so we have to go to online.
All right, let me just, John Havens, I have a question for you, and then we're going to wrap this all up. You know, you're the VP of Business Development for Blog Talk Radio, which is this great online venture that allows essentially anybody also to have their own podcast/blog out there. How do you manage the content and what's happening when people could talk essentially about anything they want, whenever they want to, whoever they want? How does that all work?
Sure. Well, first of all, people can choose to, when they sign up for a profile, it just takes a couple minutes. And when they sign up to do a show, they can rate it, you know, if it's sort of public for everyone. I forget. I don't think we call it adult. We call it, you know, because we don't allow, you know, obviously porn or that type of stuff.
Mm.
But I think one thing is that there's also room for, quote, both, you know, meaning we have Mike Huckabee is using our network to help with his presidential campaign, and John McCain may be using us. So obviously most people would say that these are guys who, along with their teams, you know, have a message that can be pretty consistent and well-spoken, whether or not you agree with them. And then we have, you know, kids who are talking about a movie they saw, or we have a very popular show about American Idol. And some people may say, well, that's not content that's necessarily going to change the world, but it gets tens of thousands of listeners and it means something to those folks.
You know, what's good about that and what's bad about that is, again, you know, I just have this horrible feeling about the next election and what's happening, because it is so easy now for people to take information that's out there, morph it into something different. I mean, we've seen this left and right, and, you know, where you take a piece of information, you post it over here, a piece of information posted over there, you attribute it to whoever. Now we have it on video and audio, and how easy it is to, you know, twist it a little bit. And this is off topic, and although maybe on topic a bit with the financial, this is going to be the YouTube election, in my opinion. You know, I mean, do you guys think that? I mean, this is going to be all about, you know, who's seeing what and who's saying what on YouTube and on various video sites.
Yeah, well, why is that a bad thing? I guess, you know, it used to be that only a very small fraction of the population got to ask a presidential candidate a question or participate in the political process. You know, if you were sort of in Iowa, early on in the election, then, you really got to be front and center. I think the idea that lots of people can participate in this election via things like YouTube and things like that is great.
I don't disagree. I don't disagree with the fact that people can participate, have your kind of an internet virtual town hall. What I have a concern about is now we take that media and we twist it into being something different than it is to begin with, because now it's readily available, where it was only in the hands of certain people. It was only in the hands of the television studios and all that before.
Yeah. I got to cut in because I got to say, now let me go to the – I'm kind of switching my tack here, but there's an amazing, amazing video cast called AliveInBaghdad.org. A guy who does it, he's a young guy, about 26. His name is Brian Connolly. He's in Baghdad. He and his camera people, he has actual Iraqi citizens helping him film stuff. He gets footage of the situation in Iraq that you will not see in any American media, period.
Right. So now we're seeing the other side. That's great. Right, exactly. Now we're no longer seeing anybody putting the clamp and filtering on us. No longer are we seeing, government at its best trying to twist our opinion, and we're seeing the other side, which nobody ever sees.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I was just going to throw this in real quickly, but I disagree with all you guys on this one. I think that the influence of this media is exaggerated by the few people who are actually involved in it. I mean, the Dan Rather thing was interesting if we look back on that, because a bunch of bloggers kind of hounded him out of his job. But the fact of the matter there was also that the general public, if nobody had done anything, it would have blown over like anything else. I don't think that this media is as influential as we'd like to believe. And then you mentioned the Baghdad, AliveInBaghdad.org, which I do recall hearing about. That's having no impact whatsoever. It's just kind of interesting for people who want to debate at the cocktail party, but I don't see anything changing because of it. I don't see anything changing because of anything that we're doing in this regard. I think it's exaggerated. I think we just have a self sense of importance when we start to jump into new media. It takes years for these things to catch on.
Well, next we're going to have icecapsmelting.com, kind of a video camera webcam just sitting on an ice cap watching it melt in real time.
I gotta disagree with John though, because the yearly COAST convention that just happened, my CEO and a bunch of people went to. There was a huge number, and all the Democratic folks were there that were talking, and it was a blog that was started 4 or 5 years ago. Likewise, supposedly someone on Barack Obama's team put up a video that emulated the Apple, the famous Apple ad with the IBM thing. And then the Hillary Clinton camp put up something to contest it. So I'm not saying that that's changing the nature of the elections per se, but I would think it's far from accurate to say that it's not influencing it.
I think it influences the people that are interested in it to begin with, rather than doing any kind of conversion. I think that's the point.
Also I should say though that in terms of getting people to vote, moveon.org, et cetera. I think one thing that's fascinating is that I heard something, I think it was the New York Times, interestingly, that reported that between the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Barack Obama campaign, they've had about the same amount of money as they go along. But most of the contributions from the Barack Obama camp are $500 and up or down or whatever. But Hillary Clinton money is usually $10,000 or $20,000. So the point there being that if Barack Obama is reaching people, and he's done things on Yahoo, he's on Twitter. He sent a Twitter about George Bush.
To be honest about it, I don't want any president or president wannabe to be on Twitter at all.
Or MySpace or Facebook.
I don't care if they're on those other things that somebody's doing, but the guy Twittering all day is something I don't want to see. But let me just go – I'll take your point to a little bit, which is, if you remember the John Dean campaign, this was an internet-oriented campaign. It got him a lot of money, got him a lot of attention. He was going to be the next president. Howard Dean. John Dean was the Nixon guy. Yeah, Howard Dean, thanks. Anyway, Howard Dean had all this, he had all this build up, and he was like going to be the shoe-in until he shows up on real TV, which is I remember when he was on the Leno show. And as soon as people got a look at this guy, it was kind of a goofball, and he just fell right into the toilet. And then, of course, he blew himself up. But I don't even think blowing himself up was the problem. It was actually him. He wasn't electable. And even though the internet took him to a certain point, the internet can take you to a certain point, but it's not going to close the deal. deal. And I think we're years away from it ever closing the deal. I think it's, if nothing else, it's just kind of an anomaly.
Yeah, well, listen, let's get back on topic, because while we could talk about this for hours, you know, this is a, unfortunately or fortunately, this is a great topic for other podcasts. We're back on finance. We got to get back, and we got to close it, because I promise my listeners we try to stay under 40. So let me, gentlemen, John, how can they get in touch with you? How can they find out what you're doing, and John Dvorak, and see all your stuff?
Dvorak.org/blog has like links to most of my stuff. I'm also at PCMag.com, MarketWatch.com. You can find me there, a couple of columns. I'm at Tech5.podshow.com and CrankyGeeks.com. I'm apparently too busy to even do this show.
Yeah, well, that's great. I see him in probably doing one or two at the same time here. Probably has a camera on him at this point. But
I do, yeah.
John Havens, tell him about where we can reach you.
Sure. Blogtalkradio.com is our home portal. I'm very interested in anyone's thoughts on transparency, and you can check out, until stuff moves along with the book, thenewpr.com/wiki. We have a page on there for transparency. Love to have your thoughts there.
All right. And what we'll do also is make sure that everybody, I'm going to get you a Parker in a second, but everybody's notes and information will be on the show notes for this. Parker, how can they get in touch with you? Where should they go to see your good stuff?
You should go check out wikinvest.com, WIKINVEST.
Okay, great.
It's a wiki with
all financial, right? I think people
are
going to really enjoy it.
It's a wiki with basically articles about companies, and then also about sort of topics like oil prices and things like that.
Yeah, but plus you also do a lot of feed and information in, which is really nice for charting and all that. The charts are great, by the way. I really like all the colors and all that. They're really, really neat. So I'll put, again, those show notes on there. And I think that I sent out, hopefully everybody's got a copy of my book. Park, I'm going to send you a copy of my book. It's, I hear, 2 weeks. Everybody should have had digital copies by now. And folks out there, if you want to get a copy, pre-order right now, go to the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and there's a bookstore on there. You can grab a copy there. Pre-order, it'll be signed by me. And, of course, I'll send you out some other goodies, and it's going to be in store in 2 weeks. And then there's no more goodies for me, unfortunately. And so hopefully you guys, John Havens, do you have a chance to read it?
I did, and I really like the, especially the first couple chapters. I like how you used specific examples of people, like the couple versus someone who'd been investing for a while. That always helps make it more, personal for me. So it made it not being as good with the financial specifics. That giving those personal examples from, like I said, a couple and a different guy and stuff, that really drew me in. I really appreciated that specificity.
Good, good. Hopefully we're going to make you a lot of money, even though these markets seem to be, doing a little roller coaster on us. Anyway, thank you for next time. Until next time, thanks a lot, guys, for joining me. And we'll have you on real soon. And again, we'll have links to everybody's sites and all the information on there. Everybody out there, thanks a lot for joining us on this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.
Hey, thanks for listening to today's podcast. We'll be here next time. Keep the emails coming in, and be sure to subscribe.